Hello, you are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. I am Tom Chick, and I am here with Christian Mazursky. Did I get that right?
I pronounce it Delahunt.
Okay. And in addition, we also have Kelly Wand. Hello, Kelly Wand.
Hey.
This week, we'll be talking about The Road. We are assuming that you have seen The Road. If you have not seen it, we are going to be talking spoilers, so now is the time to bail. So, 3, 2, 1. Okay, spoilers are fair game from here on out.
What if they didn't hear that part, and now they're just coming late, because they are sick of your intro every week?
Anybody who does not want to listen to REM deserves to have The Road spoiled. It's a great REM song, and I just wanted, I was going to play It's the End of the World, and we know, like, that's
too predictable.
I know, too predictable, and so I was going through, there's this awesome sort of regretful song called I Remember California, which to me captures a lot more of The Road, so I was like, you know what, screw it. I'm going to play I Remember California, which is what you just heard.
But The Road's on the East Coast, isn't it? Does that matter at all?
That's a good question. I think...
are they holding the map upside down, spoiler alert?
Ah, good point. Very good point, it could be. I Remember California, though, Kelly Wand, is not about California. Don't be so literal-minded.
Oh. So it's about California in the same sense that Born in the USA was about Reagan.
Okay, I'll go with that, sure.
Can I do my shtick yet?
Do you have shtick for us this week? I would love for you to do shtick. Do
you have to reintroduce me and set it up.
Ladies and gentlemen, with his taglines this week, the imitable Kelly Wand.
Yeah, hey, here's some observational tagline for you. Remember back in the old days when they had butter that they put on the popcorn? And then they changed it to butter topping because there was no actual butter in it. And when I saw The Road this week, it just said topping.
Oh, ouch.
So that's my tagline, my catchphrase for this week. It's just simply topping.
Okay. First of all, by the way, you actually buy that junk? Like when you go to a...
I'm curious to see if it will, if there's even any butter in it. Because I know it's just some vaguely yellow grease they scooped off the floor. If they're not even going to lie to me that there's butter in it now.
Okay, it's a new form of honesty, I guess. So we've all seen it, I presume. Kelly Wand, did you leave halfway through?
No. How could I?
Because you left Where the Wild Things Are. I mean, it's your modus operandi.
Well, this is a much better adaptation than Where the Wild Things Are. So I stopped at the very end.
Right out of the gate. Right out of the gate, Kelly. Exactly. Lays out his cards. Very nice.
Dingus, do you care to lay any cards on the table before we
start? No, I'm going to hold mine close to my chest.
Okay, let me lay a card on the table. I didn't care for the movie at all.
You're high.
No.
That's my
I do have a cold, and I am on cough medicine right now, and you might hear I sound super sexy, but I'm not.
You didn't like the cinematography? You didn't like Viggo Mortensen's awesome acting? You didn't like
Let's see. Yes, no. Go ahead. You have more.
You didn't like Viggo?
not really.
Wow.
My bigger problem, though, wasn't with Viggo. I mean, I don't know if we want – I'll just launch into this. I had a serious – I tried really hard, and Kelly Wand, I want to talk to you about this because when we talked about An Education, you wanted to talk a lot about the memoir on which it was based. And that's fair enough, but Dingus and I hadn't read it, so we were like, shut up about that. We want to talk about the movie. When we saw Where
but
the
if
Wild
– had read it, I think you would have cared.
When we saw Where the Wild Things Are, Dingus wanted to talk about the book and how it did and didn't relate to the book, and I couldn't have cared less. I tried really hard to divorce what I knew of the book. All three of us have read Cormac McCarthy's The Road, and I think it means a lot to all three of us. It's a book we all like very much. So I tried really hard to sort of divorce my expectations, and I think I've succeeded. And even given that, I had a few problems with it. I thought it was overly sentimental. I did not like kid actor one bit, and I thought that it missed a few very important points that the book was trying to make, and by missing those points, it kind of went astray. So I did not care for it, and there's my cards on the table.
Now, when you say, Tom, that it missed points, are you saying that it missed action moments or scenes, or are you saying that it missed thematic moments?
Primarily, I didn't feel that it was able to establish their desperation the way the book was. The fact that normally when you have an end-of-the-world movie, you have something convenient like zombies or a virus or earthquakes to sort of establish shorthand for desperation. If what you're facing is hunger and a lack of plant life and no companionship, that's really, Cormac McCarthy captures that beautifully with his prose, and it's part of what's amazing about the book. And I just felt the movie didn't establish that very well for me. And I felt that that sense of desperation was missing. When he presses the gun to the boy's head, I didn't feel like the movie had earned it the way this scene is earned in the book. And I didn't for a second think that there was any danger that he was going to shoot the kid. I mean, it just, a lot of the stakes that are clear in the book are harder to spell out in the movie, and I felt it was unsuccessful to doing that.
Now, Tom, are you positive that this is because I'm saying this wrong? Are you positive that this isn't because you know what's going to happen?
No, not at all, not at all. No, I freely grant. I would love to talk to someone about this movie who hasn't read the book. Like, for instance, Dingus, our friend Charles. I don't think he's read the book. I would be curious what someone like him thinks of it. So, no, I can't say. It's like I said before, I'm trying to divorce my expectations from having read the book from my reaction to the movie, and I think I'm successful. I'm not entirely positive. So I don't have a good answer for that, Dingus.
And that was going to be my biggest question for both you and Kelly was, and then this occurred to me about three quarters of the way, maybe two thirds of the way through the film, to ask you guys, do you wish at any point during this film, do you wish you had not read the book? Not to lose the experience of reading the book, because it's an incredible experience, right, but do you wish there could be an alternate reality wherein you had not read the book?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I would say yes.
It's impossible for me to make that leap. I just can't picture not having read the book and seeing this.
So can you sort of picture, Kelly, like, would you, like you dug it and that's cool.
I think you make some good points. I think that scene did feel wrong with where he's holding the gun to the kid's head.
And in the book, that's huge. I mean, that's so
significant.
It's
a very important scene. And right. I felt like Cody Smith McPhee, and he has a really tough load to carry, the Australian child actor who plays the kid, as he's known in the movie. But he never seemed sincerely traumatized to me. And he looked too healthy. But Vigo,
he looked way too healthy.
Yeah, they have that one scene where he's in the bathtub and they kind of try to show that his clavicles are protruding. But it could have been a body double.
But he stands in front of the mirror and says, "We're skinny," and I'm thinking, "You're not."
Yeah.
You've been eating well.
His face was kind of jowly for but Vigo, I thought, was really good, and I'm surprised Tom, and it kind of sold me on the rest of the movie. But between that and the cinematography, I sort of fell for it. And I thought it was hard for me to visualize the road really being adapted any other way than the way they did it.
And that's a fair point. Like, if I was sitting in John Hillcoat's director's chair, I would just kind of throw my hands out. Like, I don't know what else he could have done. And I liked his, you know, I could see him trying.
So I approached the movie on that level, and, I don't know. I couldn't tell what anyone would think of. I there were a lot of moans in the audience, and I wasn't sure. I go, they couldn't have read the book, or they wouldn't be moaning.
What do you mean they wouldn't? Because they would have known that.
Yeah, like you said, you know he's not going to shoot the kid. And the book ends on a kind of an up note, which to me was sort of an un-Cormac McCarthy touch. It's actually probably one of my least favorite Cormac McCarthy novels.
I would say, from what I've read, it's his most positive. I mean, it's clearly his most up.
It's like he couldn't bear to end on a bleak note.
Right.
Because
right.
He has a kid. And to me, that was selling out by Cormac McCarthy standards compared to, like, Blood Meridian or Child of God.
So I want to talk at some point about differences from the book, because I think some of those are important. But I also want to get So Dingus, you, Kelly Wan and I have laid our cards on the table. You're up. That's up.
I think it's an excellent film, but I don't know how to feel about it. I had such a hard time, and I felt like, you know, I'm glad you opened with talking about how we reacted to Kelly bringing up the memoir last week, because after we got off the phone, I felt like a total hypocrite for how much I harped on Where the Wild Things Are. And how I held forth on that. And then when Kelly brought up the memoir, I was right with you saying, okay, yeah, I don't want to hear about that. Let's just talk about this movie. And then as I watched The Road, I felt like I was just watching a filmed version of the book, not an adaptation so much as a filmed version of the mm-hmm. book, mm-hmm. not an interpretation either. And it took me back to what you said, Tom, when we were talking about Where the Wild Things Are, about how you're fine with a director and a screenwriter taking a piece of source material and and running with it and making their own interpretation and coming up with something, while not altogether new, but something fresh and something that's from them. And I think that the adaptation here is so, I hate to use the word slavish, but so,
I could interject, maybe devoted, like I really got the sense that John Hillcoat loved the book and didn't want to change one jot or tittle.
Devoted is a good way to put it. Because of that, whenever something would happen, I could just see the page in my head and know, well, I know what's going to happen here, so there's nothing to worry about. And never felt like there was anything to worry about, and I didn't connect it to what you said about them not earning it when they were upstairs or when the kid was pushing the emotional scenes and not really getting there. I just kept feeling like I know exactly what's going to happen in every, and I know where we're going to end up, and I just feel no sense of suspense. That all that said, I think the movie is put together beautifully, and I'm surprised that you don't like it so much.
It really was, like, I agree with the cinematography, and I loved some of their shots of what the end of the world looked like. Like, and there were times that I just had a huge, like, when they're walking, there's one scene with a deep focus and there's a bunch of telephone poles sort of askew and it looks like,
yeah.
Or I loved some of those shots. I mean, even him like on the overpass with the truck rig and his wedding ring, like some of those sequences were really beautiful.
And those are real places too. They're not sets because they didn't have the budget to CG it. So it's even more.
How did they?
It's like in The Incredible Hulk, the best scene is that shot of the slums at the very beginning. It's like a real place, so it's even more awesome. And then the movie sucks right after that.
Well, that's interesting, Kelly, because I wanted to ask about that ring sequence that when they're in that amazing overpass.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask if that was real, because it seems so unbelievably high up that there's got to be some sort of wizardry going on there.
Speaking of wizardry, did you guys think of Lord of the Rings? Because it was Viggo sliding.
Yeah, I felt bad.
Of course I did. When he put the ring down, I couldn't help it.
Yeah. Doesn't put it on. But Tom, I think part of it, well, this goes for both of you, but Tom's more upset. Not upset, but...
I'm nerd raging.
Yeah. I don't think this movie could have lived up to your expectations, because I know this is your favorite book of like the last 5 years or something. So I knew you weren't going to like it no matter what before I even saw it.
But go ahead.
Did you see the trailer for it?
Yes. Oh, crap. I always watch a trailer after the movie to see what would have been ruined. The trailer would have ruined the movie so much as it would have completely misrepresented it.
Yes.
Holy cats.
It did. It's chock-a-block with Charlize. It's barely in the movie. Appropriately.
Dingus, have you seen the trailer, by the way?
No, I didn't.
Hilarious.
The trailer has fake newscasts announcing a cataclysm coming up that's not in the movie at all.
There's even a tornado in the trailer.
Yes, there's a tornado in the trailer.
Where did they borrow some
expectations
footage from 2012?
So,
it's that kind of thing. They definitely they spliced in like disaster footage.
Yeah, they marketed it as 2012.
Yeah,
so it's
absolutely.
Even dumber. It's amazing.
It's pretty shameless, too. But where were you going with that, Kelly? I cut you off.
Oh, just that trailer was so bad and felt so wrong that I went in with such low expectations that the cinematography and Viggo's acting were enough to impress me. Like it was so much more, there was so much more fidelity to the novel than I expected.
Right.
And it's only the second Cormac McCarthy movie we have at all. So, you know,
not true. Billy Bob Thornton did all the Pretty Horses.
Okay. Third. So there's three.
But no, you're right. It's go ahead though.
Well, and it's the most cosmic, like it's apocalyptic Cormac McCarthy. So.
So let me spell out for you guys more specifically. Like, so I felt it didn't earn the stakes, because that's a huge part of the book is, and as a matter of fact, that's a huge part of any end of the world movie. I tried to sort of sell you guys before on this idea that there's a difference between a disaster movie and an end of the world movie. And an end of the world movie really has to establish stakes in a completely different way than a disaster movie or an adventure movie. Any end of the world movie has to be about really difficult decisions. For instance, what they do when the guy tries to steal their stuff on the beach, or how they react to Robert Duvall, or do they save the people in the cellar? You know, all these are important moral decisions you have to make when it's the end of the world. In a stupid movie like 2012, just glibly ignores them, and we have a bad guy. Oliver Platt is the oily bad guy who, you know, it's not a moral decision. It's a good or bad thing.
Well, it pretends to give – it gives lip service to those ideas by having a Russian dude toss his kid up and then fall into the chasm unnecessarily.
But all that's crappy disaster.
Like, that's a decision he made. Like, oh.
Right. But that's all – those are all disaster movie tropes, like all of that crap. But in an adventure movie, moments like – you really need to sort of establish how, in an End of the World movie, you establish, you know, the fact that they don't save the people in the cellar. That's a huge moment, but it sort of gets glossed over here. The fact that they can't find food is a huge part of the book. There's this tangible sense of relief in the book when they happen upon that cache of food. In the movie, I think there's maybe like one point where the kid says he's hungry, and I think there were a couple of voiceovers by Viggo Mortensen. And it was sort of like they had to do that to establish a sense of hunger. And the kid looked healthy, and yeah. I just didn't feel like it was earning the fact that you have to do terrible things like leave the people in the cellar or abandon Robert Duvall on the side of the road or, you know, brutally reciprocate what the guy did at the beach, you know, by leaving him naked like he was going to leave them. There didn't seem to be the proper weight behind those kinds of decisions. And I have some examples of other movies that I feel did that better that I'll bring up later. But another problem that I really had was that the kid they cast. I mean, for one thing, he was so much older than... The book is hugely about, if I die, what is going to happen to this 5-year-old boy who's too young to take care of himself?
Right,
and there's
no
counterpart to that with how old Cody Smith-McPhee, I think I'm screwing up his name. But that kid, I mean, he was still young, but you didn't get the sense that he was going to be a vulnerable little kid on the side of the road when Viggo Mortensen dies. And that's another example of the stakes that we're missing that make the book work so well and that make the man's dilemma so agonizing.
Just like in the movie, Max is older than he is in the book, and just like in An Education, she's older than she is.
But here's the difference, Kelly Wand. Max Records and Carey Mulligan were excellent actors in those two movies. I didn't feel that this kid was that good of an actor, and it really hurt the movie. If they're going to have him older, that's fine if that's what it takes to get a really good kid actor in there. You know, this movie ends with a long shot on his face, and there should be stuff going on, but it was like, I've talked about George Clooney at the end of Robert Clayton. What the heck is that movie called?
Michael Clayton,
right. George Clooney says this blank look on his face, and that poor kid at the end of the road, there's nothing going on in his face. You know, at the end of Where the Wild Things Are, there's so much going on in Max Record's face. It's beautiful. And there's none of that.
I missed that part.
Yes, you did. Suck it. How dare you? You left.
I'm glad you brought that up, Tom, because there's one moment that really ruins his age for me. I haven't read the book in a while, and I don't have it here because I think I borrowed it from you. And I couldn't verify a lot of the differences in the book, and I know we're going to get into this, but there's that flashback / dream scene where he and the mother, where Viggo Mortensen and the mother are talking at the table about the bullets, and the boy is in another room drawing on the wall. Yeah. And what was so confusing to me was he seems just as old as he is in the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And so in a few scenes when he says, I can't remember anymore, I feel like saying, well, it was just the other day. because my impression from the book is that she left them years ago.
Yeah.
And that he's been with this boy and doing this on his own for some time. And that's why she's a distant memory for the boy. Now, I don't know if that jibes with what goes on in the book, but it was so jarring to see him in the scene with her. It really threw me.
Yeah.
Is my sense correct there? Am I
off? That's absolutely correct. I mean, the boy's age is basically a gauge for how long – it's shortly after he's born, if I'm not mistaken, that she disappears, which, by the way, I felt worked terribly in the movie. That's very similar to how it is in the book. She just sort of wanders off. But in the movie, that I thought, again, it was an example of not earning the stakes. You haven't established that she wants to shoot herself and her son, that things are that bad. And when she just wanders off into the darkness, I thought it looked kind of silly. Like, I didn't feel that they'd really earned that.
Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to say, you're absolutely right about that disparity is, you know, in the room drawn on the wall, you're right. It's just like it's the other day, because obviously it's the same actor, and whatever they've done to try to make him look younger doesn't work.
I think they put a wig on him.
And a lot of makeup to cover the lines in his face, yeah.
Well, I started to wonder with the way they had her disappear in this sort of ethereal way. She walks off and the snow just sort of envelops her. I started to wonder, well, are we supposed to, and I don't recall this from the book, I don't recall it being like this at all, are we supposed to look at the flashback / dreams as his perspective, right, and maybe not reality?
Right.
And I don't know that's proper. I think it makes more sense if we can feel sort of a sense of the objective truth of it, but I don't know that that's necessarily true either. I can't remember those things.
Well, there's a great scene later in the movie where it's a flashback that I think is obviously like dream embellished, where he's putting his hand between her legs and there's obviously some sexuality to it.
Right.
And you get the sense that this is his longing and not necessarily any specific moment. And it's even like maybe saturated color or soft focus or something. So that stuff. If the movie had made a more conscious choice there, that would have worked. But, you know, it seemed like it was playing for a realistic scene of this is what happened rather than a recollection, for the most part.
Go
ahead.
That's okay. I was just going to say, and then you can go, Kelly. Tom, I am interested to hear some of those examples you said of films that earned it, because I don't know that I necessarily agree, but it's hard for me to evaluate because of my problem of feeling like I know everything that's going to happen.
Right.
Like specifically the scene where they're upstairs and he's got the gun to the kid's head. I don't know that you're being fair to it to say that they haven't earned it. But I'm interested to hear what your other examples are that would drive that home. Go ahead, Kelly.
I was just going to say something about – I don't remember the book well enough, but I remember thinking when I read the book that they left the fallout shelter a little hastily, I remember thinking. And I don't remember them noticing that they were being followed or a dog at that point.
I think they ran into it. I think they see a dog when they're in a city.
Okay. Well, but why did they leave the fallout shelter in the book?
They were just done.
No. I don't think they were done, because I think there was this sense that they had to leave behind this really safe, well-stocked place, carrying as much as they could. I could be wrong.
Oh, okay.
What was the movie teasing, by the way, that the dog they saw was Guy Pearce's? Like, Guy Pearce's family hadn't been following them that long, had he?
We don't know, and if I hadn't read the book, I would have been extremely annoyed by this Deus Ex Machina ending.
I know.
To show up and go, hey, we've been following you. Oh, was he your dad?
I mean,
why didn't they make contact with them all this time if they were following them that long? If they've been following them since the fallout shelter, why haven't they encountered each other?
And I think that's another example of where the book, one of the most jarring things about the book is that early scene with, by the way, poor Garrett Dillahunt, you know, who plays the...
Yeah, seriously.
So in that early scene, the book establishes that as soon as you see someone, you cannot trust them. You know, that people have been on the road for so long and people are so desperate and so hungry that this perfectly reasonable thing, like, come on over to the truck, you're a doctor, we have a wounded man, we need your help. Never believe any of that, you know. So there's this sense... It, you know, that's very clear in the book, but I don't think the movie establishes that as well. And they're constantly, too, running into people. Like, in the book, there's the sense that they're the last people in the world because they go for 50 pages without talking. They're meeting.
Yeah.
But in the movie, it's, you know, every 10 minutes they're bumping into another mob or a guy wandering by the side of the road. The movie doesn't establish that sort of loneliness as well. And again, I sympathize because it's a movie. You can't have 50 pages of an internal monologue. And another problem with the movie establishing this stuff is he can't tell his son this stuff. You know, they have to do a voiceover a few times, but it's very much about a guy putting on a brave face in the face of hopelessness. He can't express it to another character, for our benefit in the audience. So he's got to sort of hide that and be brave for his son, and therefore he looks kind of brave for us, and therefore, it doesn't really it doesn't tell us how desperate things are.
Well, and something else I think the movie fails to convey that the book does, and that was missing for me, even though I like it, was in the book, you get a sense of him teaching the kids survival skills.
Yeah.
And it was a survivalist tale. And there was like, there were, I think 30 pages of him on the boat and like figuring out what to take and which cover. And it doesn't make for very, streamlined movie storytelling. But that there was none of that in the movie, like not even any lip service to it.
You could see Kelly Wand very briefly. I mean, it does. He's so competent in the book. Like
yeah.
when he talks about, like, for instance, in the movie, you very briefly see him putting a wad in the bottom of a plastic bottle cut in half to strain boiled water into like that's their one little survival sequence.
And when he when he runs the bath at the beginning,
which I love that scene, and I don't know if that makes sense to people who haven't seen the movie. By the way, that's another one I wonder about. When she says,
"You,
well,
you
take,
haven't read the book?"
Right. Like I love that bit of dialogue, and in the it's so memorable from the book, and I loved that they opened with it. But I would wonder, do people who haven't read the book, do they understand that?
I love that too, but I did get the sense as soon as I saw it that we were in sort of for the Rhodes greatest hits,
and that
we were going to get just about every greatest hit, and I can only think of one scene we didn't get that was sort of a primary set piece in the book that didn't show up.
Is it the pregnant woman?
Roasted baby.
Kelly Wand, no. you went to the really gross part. I was trying to be elliptical about it.
No, I was thinking of the truck that they look down in.
Oh God, that's right, and that's so cinematic.
Right, and that's why it was surprising to me that it wasn't there. But I couldn't really say it as a complaint because they hit so many of the other greatest hits, and I kept thinking, oh good, I get to see this scene. Oh good, I get to see that scene. But I ended up feeling unsatisfied by each one of them because it was just you might as well have been reading those pages to me, and I kept feeling like I'm just being unfair. And again, I think it's a really well made movie. I just was puzzled by why I left it feeling unmoved, given that it's a father son story and that the book terrified me. I mean, I can't remember reading a book where I would want to skip ahead pages just to see are they okay? Does he get back to the boy? Every time he left the boy in the book or the shopping cart, every time he separated himself from the boy, I freaked out. And I didn't necessarily feel that, although I think it's a beautiful film. I was thinking that the fault just lies with me.
No. I mean, the book too, he's coughing blood, I think, like on page two.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not this big reveal in the third act that he's got issues.
And that's also such a big part of the stakes.
So you know it's only going to end one thing, right? Yeah. The best case scenario is not that good.
And here's another example where they have to establish the stakes there. So halfway through, there's a voiceover. The voiceovers are few and far between, but they have to give a voiceover where he says, "I'm dying." And that's just sort of the unenviable place they're in, is there's no one for him to say that to. So he just says it straight to the audience in a voiceover.
But I think there are ways to film those pages with nobody talking and those long spaces. And for some reason, when you bring that up, Tom, that they can't do those types of things, I don't know why this is, but I think of the assassination of Jesse James when you bring those things up, because it seems to me that there were a lot of stretches in that movie where there was silence and we still understood what was going on.
Right.
And maybe I'm giving that too much credit.
Well, I think that the movie of The Road was a little afraid to take too long. Like there were a few long shots of them crossing the horizon and whatnot, but it was so driven by set pieces that it lost some of that. You know, Assassination of Jesse James is beautiful and languid and very literary, and the voiceover works. And I just think there's a big difference between what Andrew Dominik did in that movie and what John Hillcoat did in this movie. And I just think the bottom line is that Hillcoat, as far as conveying a narrative and trusting sort of a slower cinematic language, just isn't the director that Andrew Dominik was.
Well, or maybe they made him shorten it. Maybe.
Well, you know, it was, you're right, Kelly, it was a very, I think, beleaguered production.
Yeah.
And I would...
Yeah, do you know anything about that? Because I just saw a couple headlines about that.
I don't. I just know that it was delayed for so long, it's been finished for so long, and I can't imagine that it doesn't have studio fingers all over it.
Yeah, well, the trailer tells us that, too.
Yeah, exactly.
That shitty trailer.
You know, they're trying to release it during you know, as a 2012.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe there's going to be a better director's cut.
But I don't understand why studios, and this is what they kept saying, oh, it's such a hard sell. Oh, yeah, it's so bleak. It's so depressing. Oh, God. And it's like, but they'll sell I Am Legend, which, you know.
Well, I Am Legend has star power. Like, I Am Legend is a Will Smith movie, and people will be tricked into seeing it for that. There's no reason for anyone to see The Road.
Well, it ends with him dying. So it's like, that's depressing.
You know what, though? You should see the original ending of I Am Legend at some point.
I saw it. It's the same thing.
Yeah, but it's got a different... they tweak it. But you're right. I mean,
they ruin it a different way. That's what I thought.
Fair enough. But there's nothing that, like, if I was... I understand the studio wants to make money, and this is a tough sell in that regard. It has no names, and it's bleak, and...
They just spent $200 million on 2012, and we get to see the world destroyed 900 different angles. But The Road, which is just... I mean, is that what's missing? Is that what they thought would make it more commercial? Is if they showed more signs of the process, the decay?
They're just trying to fool people into making a reasonable opening weekend. And what happens after that is of little consequence,
yeah.
Because they're going to have a drop off regardless. And word of mouth is not going to make any difference, because the people who really want to go see it, like us, are going to go regardless. And the people they tricked will have been tricked, and it doesn't matter who they tell, because those people probably wouldn't have come in anyway.
Right. I think the big barriers were the production actually getting off the ground. Like, the fact that it was made, we can thank Oprah's Book Club and
the Coens
and the success of No Country for Old Men. That's what got it made. And now that it's been made, people are just trying to make money back, I guess. So here's another thing, and you brought up Assassination of Jesse James Dingus. Here's another thing that I hated about it. And I don't know if you guys noticed this. Dingus, I suspect you did, because you have as low a threshold of tolerance for this as I do. There's an Australian group called Dirty Three. And they did the soundtrack for a movie called Praise, which was from, I think, maybe 99, 2000. And Dirty Three includes a fellow named Warren Ellis, who's a classically trained violinist. And his sort of signature sound is putting a guitar pickup on a violin. And that's what the music in Praise is like. He later hooks up with Nick Cave. And they do the soundtrack for The Proposition, which was John Hillcoat's last movie before The Road, and I think his first movie. And they did the soundtrack for Assassination of Jesse James. And their soundtracks have this great sort of longing quality, and Warren Ellis's violin is very prominently featured. And now they've done the soundtrack for The Road. And I hated this soundtrack. And part of the problem with it, I think, is it relies so much on piano, I think, because they're trying to tie into Charlize Theron playing the piano and the scene where he breaks down in front of the piano. And it just comes across as sentimental and sappy and too intrusive for me. So I really, really dislike the soundtrack immensely. Did that bother either of you guys? Like, there were times I was like, just shut up, soundtrack. The movie can be quiet and go with sort of Viggo Mortensen's haunted face and these great cinematography and the sets. I don't need you dribbling your music over the proceedings. did that bother either of you?
The things that bothered me, Tom, were the score has this tendency to really let you off the hook emotionally,
yeah.
Far too many times. So that whenever there's a moment when it's okay to feel okay again, the score lets you know that. It plays this like happy, not happy, but more calming. Okay,
yep.
They're out of danger now. Don't worry. It's a touching moment. You can feel okay. There's not going to be any cannibals jumping up behind them. I don't want to feel okay. I don't want you to tell me how to feel. I just want to be able to go along with the movie. And there were times when I really liked the score, when it was being less intrusive. I don't remember sort of the any epic moments that like bothered me, and some in Education, but those little moments when usually we're looking at the boy's face too, there would be this sort of gentle music that would come in to make me feel okay, and I didn't like that.
Right, it's like it was soothing your hair back.
Exactly. It's okay.
It's okay. They're like, quit touching me. Kelly, did that bother you, or did you notice the music?
His last name shouldn't be Hillcoat. It should be Sugarcoat.
Nice. Ladies and gentlemen, Kelly Wand.
Check, please. I tuned it out like AM radio static. I didn't really notice it because I was really impressed by the sound design, like those grumbles and those basso profundo temblors when the earth was shaking and stuff. And there was no score.
I did love that stuff. I loved this sense that the Earth was like in a submarine movie where you hear the hull creaking.
Yeah.
I loved the sense that the Earth was under pressure and that, you know, I don't remember if there were earthquakes in the book, but I loved, and I hated the kind of goofy, hey, we're dodging the trees scene. Like, that was silly.
That's from the book, though, I think.
Is it? Okay.
A lot of goofy shit from the books in the movie.
But I loved the sense that the world was creaking and groaning and ruffling and falling apart. That stuff was beautiful.
And just catching on fire for no reason.
Yes, yes, yes.
Even though it's wet and damp, there's still fires, just spontaneous combustion of forests.
I quite liked that.
So that overwhelmed any irritation I felt. The piano stuff, it's just so spelled out and so Spielbergian. There's just no texture to it. It's just like, yeah, I get it. They liked each other. Hand on thigh, hand on hand, hand on key, hand, hand, hand.
And maybe it's only I noticed it because I realized that it was Warren Ellis and Nick Cave. I mean, maybe if I hadn't known that.
That's not the comic book Nick Ellis or Warren Ellis, is it?
You know what? It's not, and I've gotten in trouble with that before. I remember linking to a story about Warren Ellis doing, I don't know, some game script or something and posting a picture of a big bearded guy. Which ended up being the wrong Warren Ellis. But
big bearded guy is the musician, right?
Correct, yes. The Warren Ellis violinist looks like a sort of a mountain man fellow.
Appropriately. do you think this will sour the well for future Cormac McCarthy adaptations? And do we care, since the adaptations can never really capture Cormac McCarthy's prose anyway? So...
Well, that's an excellent question. I have not seen All the Pretty Horses, but I know that that's one where I think Billy Bob Thornton has vocally sort of...
denounced it.
Exactly. He's disowned it. And I think that No Country for Old Men, and I remember reading this, is very uncharacteristic of Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah, it started as a script, I read.
Oh, I didn't,
which I didn't know.
That makes sense, because it's sort of like Cormac McCarthy trying to do, you know, like a thriller, or almost like an airport novel. But the awesome thing is he subverts it all at the end, and it's sort of like it refuses to be typical.
Yeah, his crappiest novel becomes Best Picture of the Year.
Exactly, right. So I can't imagine, like, I know there's...
Blood Meridian.
Well, that's the thing, is I know there's been some rumbling about Ridley Scott doing a Blood Meridian.
I think he's off that.
I can't imagine that's ever going to happen. And if it does, I don't...
It will suck. It will suck.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing.
I can't do it.
My typical thing is I would love to see someone's interpretation of it. I'm more convinced.
Even if it's McGee, your favorite.
Yes, sure. If McGee loves Blood Meridian and he wants...
That's worse than nothing.
I'm seriously okay with that. I've said this before. I'm okay with that Tick Tambimber dude doing Moby Dick.
How dare you?
Write an angry letter while I see it open weekend. So I would love to see other interpretations of Cormac.
Bastardization apologists in the house once again.
Guilty as charged, sure. So I don't know. I don't think the movie's gonna do well, but it can't have cost much.
It'll be nominations.
Really? What do you think it'll be nominated for?
Viggo will get nominated.
Oh, I disagree.
You don't think so?
I don't think it.
I'll bet you $5.
I will.
That'll be fun.
Let's do something more fun than $5. I mean, what's $5?
All right, $20. I don't have...
No. I meant like on the podcast. Yeah. I don't know. We know we're going to do a whole Academy Award episode, so we'll bring that up then. But I really don't see it as being a nomination performance.
I think it's got a shot.
Really?
I think it's got a shot for Best Picture, and they've got to fill 10 slots.
Good point. Not 10 slots for Best Actor, though, right? That's just Best Picture?
No,
that's
just Best Picture.
That's going to set up the Oscars.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so maybe, okay.
Then you get to see 10 clips per 3 hour. Are they going to add 10 to every category, like sound editing?
No, that's what Dingus was just saying, is it's just Best Picture gets 10.
Why? That's a stupid... That's like changing a key rule of baseball or basketball. Like,
well, save your ire for the Academy Awards podcast. We'll definitely do one.
I think they're trying to make it possible for people to feel more comfortable about nominating really good comedies, because it seems very difficult to do that.
So they can still lose.
Oh, they certainly probably will. I mean, it's hard to...
Even though comedy's the toughest thing to write.
Exactly. But, you know, it's also tougher to play a regular dude than somebody who's retarded, but they always fall for that too.
Well, you don't go full retard, as Robert Downey Jr. explained.
God, we're quoting Tropic Thunder. I'm so low brow.
So Tom, I want to actually go into a little bit more, because I was actually quite touched by Viggo Mortensen. He was probably one of the only things in the film that really moved me. And I wanted to ask, and I don't necessarily want to go into a line by line what's different from the book, but there are some questions I have. Because I remember when I first found out he was cast, my impression from reading the book was that the man was much older.
Yeah, I picture him as Cormac. It's Cormac and his kid wandering around.
Did maybe not that old, sense, but yeah. Well, you know what? I don't remember the age, but I mean, it's clearly Cormac McCarthy. Yeah, I mean, I think it's clearly like an older guy. Viggo worked as far as like age. I didn't think.
Yeah, well, once I actually saw the movie, and I think the makeup is actually quite good. I like how he came across, and he worked, because he's got this great weariness about him. So that wound up working for me, and I'm just curious as to why it didn't work at all for you, because I think he does a great job, and does as much as he can to try to establish a relationship with this boy, where they don't really have any chemistry at all. And I just wonder if I kept trying to make excuses for that, thinking, well, it's okay for this particular relationship that they don't have any chemistry because of the situation and because of the loss of the mother, and he's trying to toughen the boy up and those types of things. But I'm curious as to why you don't like him at all.
It's not that I don't like him at all. And I think he did well. Like I enjoyed watching him, and it did salvage some of it for me, but I just didn't feel it was really enough to carry the movie. And even the scenes with Charlize Theron, she's tremendous. He's tremendous. Things weren't clicking. The stakes didn't feel right for me. And it was mainly the kid. Like for something like that to really feel moving to me, I've got to feel like he's getting something back for what he's giving. And I didn't feel that kid was giving him back anything. In the scenes between them. So I you know, it's sort of like damning with faint praise, but I want to say, yeah, he was fine, but.
Yeah, okay.
He was fine.
I know, that's terrible, isn't it?
An Oscar nomination, ladies and gentlemen.
And I think Charlize Theron was great, too, given what she had to do, because she struck the right balance, I thought. She was cold without being a complete bitch, and kind of got some of that feeling of terror and not being able to cope and needing to just leave across in those scenes, and what's a really difficult role.
Yeah. You know what she was better in, though?
Sweet November?
No. The episode of Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis. And you guys think I'm joking, but watch it.
I'm writing it down. Is it a disaster or an apocalypse movie?
No, she was good, and I love her. I adore her. I like them both, but it's just they deserved a better movie.
I think the kid ruined your ability to.
You know what? You're right. Yeah, like for instance, I really liked the scene where they're talking at the table and they're trying to be quiet with the kid in the next room. Like I liked the concept of that, and they're both very good. And in another movie, I think I would have adored that scene. And you know, the fact that he has to sort of whisper and keep his voice down. That was a good scene. I would want to watch a clip of it again, but not the whole movie again.
I like the concept of that scene, but what kept nagging me during it is that, you know, I've got a 5-year-old and he hears everything.
Right. And they're being kind of loud.
And he pretends he's not listening or he's doing something else. But if you say the right keyword and he's in the other room, he'll perk up and repeat exactly what you said back to you. And I know that kid was hearing everything they were talking about. But and now I'm sort of starting to dawn on me what you mean by stakes, because they're talking about an incredible subject.
Yeah.
And that kid doesn't seem to echo with him. Or to resonate, I should say, resonate with him.
And the fact that he's too old to pull off that level of ignorance and to whimper like a little kid.
Oh, and saying things like "Papa." I mean, clearly it's dialogue from the book written for a little 5-year-old boy, and actions for and I didn't, you know, a kid his age who's been through what he's been through, you know, still it just. There was
but maybe
this weird
he's just infantilization. He just feels 5 because he's the only kid he knows, and so he's sort of stuck in this. Perpetual fiveness,
which also reminds me. So the little boy he sees, is that Guy Pearce's family following him?
No, I don't think so.
No, but you say that, but think of someone who's seen the movie and doesn't know whether or not that's the case from the book. Is that what the movie is pointing towards?
Well, why does he run away then? Like, why? Because they were close to each other and they wanted to talk to them.
No, Guy Pearce is obviously like, let's follow these people, let's see what's going on, you know, because people can't talk to each other. I mean, that was a weird thing for months. Yeah, I mean, was the little boy imaginary? Was the movie saying that? I don't know the answer to that, but just now thinking of that when you say that, Kelly, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, was the movie trying to get us to think that Guy Pearce has been there, that's his little boy that they saw, that's his dog that they heard when they were in the shelter? I don't know the answer to that.
When you read the book, did you think that the kid being rescued into good hands at the end was possibly the man's dying hallucination, a la Taxi Driver?
That's actually great. I love that, Kelly.
Well, that I'm glad you brought that up, because in the book at the ending, if either of you remember it, is the man still alive when the boy goes into their hands?
No, not at all.
No, but all maybe right. That's part of his hallucination. He's hallucinating that he's dead, and then these guys rescue him.
That's actually lovely, Kelly. I don't know the answer to that, but that makes me want to – I mean, seeing the movie made me want to read the book again, but that makes me want to read it again. I loved – and this comes from just the continuity with – Tommy Lee Jones or Ed Tom's last dream in No Country for Old Men, this idea about carrying the fire. Yeah. And that's just, I'd totally forgotten that was in there, and that ties in with Ed Tom's dream, where he has a dream about his father carrying fire and a Viking horn, riding ahead in the snow to set up a camp for him when he catches up.
I
forgot that.
They're just, it's just a lovely point of continuity between the two books.
It's in all of his books, I think. That's a thread through all the Cormac stuff.
Like a father carrying fire?
Yeah. Well, a Western... Yeah. Like a father's... Yeah, I think so. Isn't it in Blood Meridian?
Everything's in Blood Meridian.
Right. Isn't there a fire in Blood Meridian? That's what I meant.
Well, I remember reading the book and just getting this sense and trying to understand what that whole thing about the fire was, that the boy... And I don't have a lot of... experience with Cormac McCarthy books, just that the boy was the fire and that maybe he was going to turn out to be some sort of a messiah figure or something.
Well, I liked that they preserved a line about, you know, if this is the word of God, if God has ever spoken, you know, that's I think the point of the book is that no matter how bleak things are, there is beauty in the world and there's a reason to be good. There's a reason to not give up hope. There's a reason to preserve hope and faith.
Unless you don't have kids, then you're screwed.
Basically, yeah. And, you know, the movie was aware of that, and it tried to get it across, and I ultimately just feel it wasn't that successful. So let me mention a few movies. And oddly enough, and I don't know where this comes from, the three directors I could think of who made what I feel are end-of-the-world movies that better establish the stakes are all Spanish. Which is a little. So first of all, I love what they did.
Racist.
I don't know. Now, Fernando Miralles, the guy who did City of God and Blindness, he's actually probably Brazilian. So isn't he Brazilian? I should have looked this up. Anyway, his name is, I think, Fernando Miralles.
Sure he is.
I thought he was from Argentina, but he might be Brazilian.
Okay, right. Well, City of God is set in Rio de Janeiro. It's about Brazilian kids in the slums of Brazil. So. Oh no! What's that?
Sorry, that's my that's the monitor. My son is acting up.
Oh, do you need to go check on him?
No. Wendy's here. I shouldn't have that on. I apologize.
That's okay. Tell him your son is now part of the podcast.
Yeah, you're being a good father.
So in Blindness, they establish the stakes about being trapped in this place with no food, and it helps because they've got all these characters to talk to and create it. And they establish this idea of selling sex for food. You know, they come to this really dire, gritty, unpleasant situation where they need food, and the sort of the moral order breaks down entirely. So I think of the way they did that in Blindness. There's another, of course, Juan Carlos Fresnadillo in 28 Weeks Later, right. Stakes for what the military has to do at the end of the world. And the military does terrible things. They're gunning down civilians and they're firebombing a place for refugees, basically. And it's this sense of, you know, that they're having to make these terrible moral choices.
But they didn't have to do that in that movie, I thought.
They did. I mean, they reached Condition Red, and Idris Elba says, you know, we have to go to Condition Red. That's an example, Kelly Wand, of a movie that subverts the usual rules by showing the military is successful. They're doing what they have to do, and they're successful. If it's not
28 weeks later,
yeah. If it's not for the fact that
they're totally unsuccessful, they let the plague out all over the world.
Well, what happened? They let it out because of
they didn't have the door sealed
because of a compassionate helicopter pilot. Otherwise, it would have worked. The beauty, I think, of 28 weeks later is that the military's decision, the military is shown as effectual.
I love that movie, and I thought it was the military was shown as hugely ineffectual.
Nope,
that was
everything
the nightmare
works.
Of the movie.
Nope, everything works. The firebombing, the gassing of the areas, and then the sending out of the teams to
infect the world.
but it's Harold Perrineau who blows it. You know, the helicopter pilot who takes pity on the kids. You know, compassion, the point of 28 weeks later, is almost the inverse of the road, is that compassion can be undoing. You know, it's the fact that Robert Carlyle, you know, kisses his wife. He's looking for forgiveness, you know. That's what does them in. So that's another Spanish director creating these huge stakes and these moral decisions and consequences at the end of the world. And another movie.
Well, wait, you have some of that. Also in Blindness, too, some of that military versus civilians thing going on there, too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Another movie is, and this is a weird one, it's a Spanish director named F. Javier Gutierrez. I think he's a first-time, he's either first-time or he's a young director. It's a movie that had a very limited release in September. It'll be on DVD next week, called Carriers. And the problem with Carriers is that it features this sort of like young, attractive, cast. Chris Pine is the lead, the guy who played Kirk. But Carriers has this great, it's another end of the world movie, and without giving away too much, it's about making really hard, difficult choices. It establishes the stakes, and it follows through with the consequences of decisions that are made for good or bad reasons. So those were three movies I thought of where, in watching all three of those movies, the stakes felt much clearer to me, and I understood the consequences of decisions. When decisions were made, they seemed clearer and more terrible and more significant than the way that holding the gun to the kid's head was almost this weird throwaway scene in The Road.
Hmm. What about in Jurassic Park when they leave the lawyer in the toilet?
Oh, jeez.
The T-Rex eats him. That was a tough decision, huh, Tom?
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, Peter Pan, Mary Free, getting down with 3 feet, everybody loves
me. I hope that was appropriately timed. I don't want to shut down any important discussion. But so this week's 3x3 is brought to you by, whose turn was it? I think this is Dingus.
Yeah, that was me. Are you going to fit?
Good fit, Tom. Really good fit.
All right. Do you want me to go ahead and introduce it? Is that what you're telling me?
Rock and roll.
All right. 3x3, of course, is our weekly feature wherein we have three films each based on some conceptual idea. This time was mine, and I asked us all to come up with three films that we would take with us to a desert island if we could only take three films for the rest of time.
I don't remember that part. I don't remember the rest of time. Maybe we get off the island.
Nah, he was pretty clear. This is no Castaway. There's going to be no rescue in the third act.
It could be on the moon. It could be a desert island.
See,
but it is.
Right.
That's it. The rest of time. No other movies. This is it.
I'd bring totally different movies to the moon than I would to a desert island.
Depends on where you're going.
And I would obsess way more about the books I would bring.
Well, we can bring that up on our books podcast.
That's an excellent idea.
No more podcasts. No. We got a downsize already.
So I think I'm going first because I'll be introducing next week's list later on. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So first of all, I want to say we've talked about this a little bit off the air, but coming up with this list is less about movies and more about me. And I can't help but feel that that's a lot less interesting to the people listening. They want to listen to us talk about movies, which we'll talk about. But unfortunately, this list is pretty much all about me.
Your island.
And we've had this discussion before, and I think the opposite. I think that people can talk about or find out what the greatest movies ever made on their own are, and they want to know what we think about them.
Well, but here, so here's why, what I'm sort of leading into is that I didn't necessarily pick great movies, because, for instance, I think there are movies that are perfect, like flawless gems. You know, I think of Casablanca or Toy Story 2 or Chinatown. You know, movies that are just exquisite creations in every sense. I don't want to take any of those with me to a desert island. I've seen them. I've enjoyed them. Instead, I
ruined them.
I mean, you want to sort of, they're like fine port in that you only occasionally have them. I don't know.
I have them.
So instead, I've picked movies that satisfy two criteria. They have to have some deep personal resonance for me, and I have to be able to sort of find new things in them every time I watch them, or at least have them sort of bring out new emotions. So all of that is by way of saying none of this is going to make any sense to anyone listening. But my number three movie, because it just says a lot about sort of my own childhood and my own perspective on children, and because it's sort of this, in a weird way, this very painful movie for me to watch, but it's very cathartic. My number three movie would be The Ice Storm.
What?
Wow.
There you go. That's exactly the reaction I expected.
Wow.
So, all right.
Let's see that coming.
What's your number three, Kelly Wand?
Oh, that is impressive.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Are you going to? All right.
No. Yeah, I mean,
you didn't really qualify your choice.
I can field questions.
What the hell are you talking about? Question one.
I love The Ice Storm. I think The Ice Storm is the performances and the cast and the different perspectives on what's going on, and how flawed and real and honest the characters are. The Ice Storm is this amazing story about the damage done by benevolent parents who treat their children like adults. That's sort of how I think of it. And I think it's, and it's also a great period piece. You know, I didn't grow up, I think it's set in Connecticut. I didn't grow up in Connecticut, but I sort of feel so much of my own childhood, the kid whipping the roses and, you know, just being destructive, and that sort of frustration and inability to understand sexuality and, being unable to connect with it's going to get very. I
don't want to see that one kid get electrocuted repeatedly.
That's no one kid. That was Frodo.
Spoiler.
Wouldn't living on a desert island preclude movies with tons of bad weather and rain? Like, wouldn't that kind of bum?
That might make it even better. And I love that you chose that, Tom. I know you see, and I even hear it in your voice. You're reluctant to reveal too much or to talk about yourself, so because I guess you think you're not interesting. But this is fascinating to me. I love this.
Yeah. Well,
and I can, because of my own personal resonance with that movie, and I wouldn't expect anyone to share this, I can watch that movie over and over again. I've probably all of the movies actually on my list I've seen easily more than 10 times. So that's. There you go. Let's see you top that, Kelly Wand.
I'm impressed. No, my list is super retarded. My number three. Well, here's the thing about my list, if I may.
Let me just ask real quick. Is Steve Guttenberg in any of the movies on your list?
He's in all three. And two of them have the word cocoon in their title.
And one is Police Academy.
Police Academy 4.
No, go ahead, Kelly Wand.
Right before he sold out. I see this I'm taking this list literally, because for me it's so hard to fathom being on a desert island and actually caring about watching DVDs instead of sleeping, that I'm taking movies that will actually come in handy on a desert island. There's no metaphor. I'm taking this completely literally. This is what I'm going to need to survive on the island. So my number three choice, which will make even less sense having said all that, is 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Wow, Dingus, I hope Dingus would get trapped on Kelly's island, because Dingus loves that movie, Kelly Wand.
Because that movie teaches you that you can make a tool out of anything, whether it's a bone or a spaceship or a monolith.
Is that the point of that movie? I'm glad to have this cleared
That's
up.
That's what I got out of it. And it cheers me up, that movie. It basically says, well, even if you die, something good's going to happen later.
Okay.
Which to me is very reassuring.
So it's also there for a little spiritual comfort.
Yeah.
Good.
To me, it's a mystic spiritual movie. And so that it fills that niche, which will help me survive on a desert island from insane. The other two are more practical, spoiler alert.
Okay. I look forward to seeing what
2001 should be on some list before the end of the year. So it's nice.
It was on an earlier list.
Which one?
Movies Ruined by the Ending, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah. You blocked that out.
No. I only remember mine. I don't remember. Ice Storm, I won't even remember that next week.
All right, Dingus, what is your number three movie you'd take to a desert island?
All right, my number three movie I would take to a desert island is a movie from 1980 called The Empire Strikes Back. Which I think is the sequel. It's the sequel to 2001, I think.
Yeah. Well, now I know your number two and your number one are Star Wars and Revenge of the Jedi or whatever the Darth Vader one was.
You always spoil. No, it's actually Wizard of Oz and Sound of Music. Thank you.
So Empire Strikes Back, by the way, is that another? Because I would almost put that in that, and maybe it's just because of my own childhood affection for it, in that category of perfect movies.
I would make it a perfect movie for me. I really struggled this week. I wasn't going to include any Star Wars films because I have them in my head. I can pretty much access them at any moment.
they're kind of on a nonstop loop, as anybody who's around you would know. Every now and then they just kind of spill out.
How dare you say that? I used to actually listen to them on I had recorded them on a cassette and would listen to them in the car on long road trips. It was pretty pathetic. Brutal. Yeah, seriously.
But that was like 6 months ago, so you're not that.
Right, exactly. Now I use my MP3
player.
Now,
even though Jedi sucks, isn't it hard to watch Empire without following it up with Jedi at some point just for closure? Ending with Han Solo frozen.
Good question.
Can't end on that. You're on a desert island, and you're ending with carbonite. Vegemite. Vegemite.
Yeah, that's right. He was encased in Vegemite.
I love that Kelly Wand pretends he doesn't know that it's carbonite. Anybody our age knows that it's carbonite. We're not falling for it, Kelly Wand.
I don't need Return of the Jedi or even Star Wars, although I love Star Wars deeply. Empire Strikes Back is the first film I remember really teaching me about anticipation, because it drove me crazy the way that movie ended, and knowing that I was going to have to wait years to find out what happened next. Years. Yeah.
And you'd waited 3 years without knowing anything about it, because that was back before the internet, and you spent 3 years really knowing nothing about Empire Strikes Back.
Wow. Yeah. You know, Kelly, that makes me wonder, like, how much is, you know, Dingus and I have this aversion to watching trailers. How much of that is this sort of wanting to recapture that part of childhood, like before movies were totally, like, spoiled and anticipated and laid out beforehand?
Yeah. That's probably 98% of it.
Maybe.
I remember vividly walking out of the theater, and I had seen, this also has a lot to do with my relationship with my father, because my parents had divorced around the time Star Wars came out. So during weekend visitations, Dad and I would see Star Wars every single time, and we saw it several times. And by the time Empire came out, I think I had moved away from him to Colorado, so I was very far away from him. And so seeing Empire Strikes Back was a real touchstone for my feelings for my dad, and then this feeling of anticipation that you're going to have to delay your gratification for the end of this series. You're going to have to wait. And I have no problem with being able to watch that, because I also think, for me, it's one of the best science fiction films ever made. And I was thinking about the beginnings of these films that I was coming up with, and thinking about those, I'm sorry to be so goofy, but those walkers walking on Hoth, and just how that just made me just tingle. And I still get some of that feeling now when I imagine the scene that not being able to watch that film ever again for the rest of my life would drive me crazy.
Good one. Okay.
I like your choice, Dingus.
I do, too. That's
even though I've broken up with Star Wars, it is a worthy.
Well, I kind of had that feeling, too, that whole F Star Wars thing, because of all how he's damaged it. And then I said, no, I'm not going to let you hurt something I love.
Very good, Dingus. Well done.
This
ties into my number two a little bit, because my number two is a crowd pleaser. My number one certainly isn't. And this movie, I know this movie by heart, but it so captures for me just what's thrilling and adventurous in a movie and what makes a good movie.
Please don't steal mine.
I might. And I saw it recently at a 4th of July screen, an outdoor screening on 4th of July. It was one of the most perfect moments of my life. And it's Jaws. Thank you, Kelly Wand. You can just do my list. So yeah, Jaws I can watch over and over again, and it's just, it's like you talking about Empire Strikes Back, Dingus. I mean, it is for me the sort of perfect movie that just, it's just the perfect thrill ride of a movie. And it gets everything right from dialogue to character.
It never gets old, too. It is weird how that movie just, when it's on, you can just leave it on.
And I kind of, when I say that I don't pick perfect movies, like when I talk about Casablanca and Toy Story 2 and Chinatown, Jaws is in there, so I kind of lied. But Jaws also, in addition to being a perfect movie, is just such a part of my childhood. When I saw Jaws, I was, let me see, 75. So I would have been 9 years old. Did I do that right? Born in 66. Yeah. So I was 9 years old. It opened that summer. I had read the book, and I knew the movie.
Yeah, I read the book, too. And it's good, huh? Remember when Hooper sleeps with Mrs. Brody?
How about that? Yeah, and he dies. And remember when they described the size of Brody's bladder as the size of
Helen. Yeah, he's forever.
Right? Yeah.
He's 200 pounds or something.
I didn't know where you were going when you said the size of Brody's.
And it went exactly where you thought.
They say the size of his bladder is like the size of a watermelon. I think his wife is listening to him pee or something. So I went to the movie. My mother took me. And from the moment that the shark jumps out when Roy Scheider's throwing out the chum, I closed my eyes. And I refused to look at what was going on. And I kept saying, my mother, what's happening now? What's happening now? What's happening now? So I didn't see half of the movie, well, a third of the movie. But then afterwards, I wanted to go back. And so I think I had a big brother at that age, you know, from the big brother program. And I think my big brother took me. And it was the same kind of thing where I could watch a little bit more of it, but then I closed my eyes. And that summer, I must have seen Jaws like 4 or 5 times, getting people to bring me until I could watch the entire thing. And it was such a formative experience for me as a kid that I sort of associate that with the idea of childhood terror and bravery in the face of adversity and overcoming fear. That's such a part of my makeup.
I'm so jealous that you got to see that in the theater when it first came out. I was slightly too young to see it then.
So you weren't allowed to, or?
I found out about it a little late. I guess my parents didn't even think, oh, yeah, we'll take the kid to Jaws. I saw Jaws 2 at a drive-in, and that was my... I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's not even, yeah.
No, I know.
Not even close.
It's not on my list.
Okay.
And when the shark gets electrocuted. It was really dumb.
I saw it in a theater, too, and I was way too young for it. I don't know what my parents were thinking. No, I don't remember a thing about it except because my dad had his hand over my eyes for most of the film. And I remember being like with kids in the neighborhood and they're talking about, the shark bites him in half and there's blood spurting out of his mouth. And I'm just going, yeah, that was really cool.
And it was a PG movie too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was, and again, I think it was the sort of thing where my mother learned from that. Like after Jaws, there was a long streak where I was not allowed to go to certain movies. And I distinctly remember I wasn't allowed to see Alien when it opened like 3 years later. Is that 79?
I snuck into that.
And I also wasn't even allowed to see 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
What?
Because it apparently had it has a scene with a giant squid, Kirk Douglas fighting a giant squid. And my mother wouldn't let me see that. I mean, I was just so sort of like traumatized by Jaws.
To your mom, that was the same as Jaws.
Do what?
To your mom, that was the same as Jaws.
Well, the thing is, I don't know why I got to go back and see it so many times that summer, but then she put her foot down for other movies. Maybe she realized that was my own personal demon I had to battle, and she didn't want me to have any further demons beyond that.
Except for tentacles.
Tentacles, which is awesome. Even though octopuses don't have tentacles, they have arms. Tentacles
is octopi.
Thank you. Good point. It's a Jaws ripoff that Kelly Wand and I watched recently, which we don't like. How about that scene with Richard Widmark on the phone? Henry Fonda.
Wait, that's The Swarm. Fonda's not in that one, is he?
Yeah.
You're thinking of Failsafe. Now, Tom, I know you go scuba diving. Does Jaws ever bother you?
I think that's no, it doesn't. That's
okay.
But the part of the beauty of things like Jaws and Paranormal Activity is they tap into a universal fear. Like when you're diving, everybody feels that weird little butterfly sensation about what if you see a huge shape moving in that sort of distant murk where you can't quite make things out. That's a universal fear, and Jaws taps into that. But the fact, when I'm diving, I don't think of Jaws as a movie. And as a matter of fact, when you're diving, sharks don't really care about divers. That's not, they bite people on accident who are swimming. So the rational part of my brain takes over fine when I'm diving. But I think anybody is scared of Jaws because anybody can appreciate that same fear that divers feel, that subconscious fear of what's in the murk beyond what you can see.
I'm petrified of the water, and I was before and after Jaws. So to me, Jaws was like, well, yeah, I'm not going into the water anyway. So
I used to, my grandfather had a lake house in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and we used to go there all the time in the summers, and I would not get in the water unless my sister got in first.
She was the bait. She was the chum.
And God bless my sister. I mean, I had a younger sister, and I would not go swimming unless Nancy got in the water first.
And that seems cruel.
I know, because, you know, I'm afraid to go in there. There could be a shark, but I'll put my sister in there. Right. And, you know, she knew I was.
She was the canary in the coal mine.
But she was willing to play bait. I mean, you know, there's no sharks in there, of course.
She didn't have your weird hang-ups.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, Tom, there's this thing between fiction and reality.
Yeah, my sister's far more
that's
willing.
That's how your sister talks, I bet.
Well done.
Thank you.
All right, so that's my number two.
Very nice.
Kelly One, let's see you top that.
I can't, but I'll say this instead. My number two is the 1930-something movie with Cary Grant, Gunga Din.
Wow.
Adventure movie. Because it proves that deserts can be fun.
What the hell?
Desert Island. Okay, Dingus's turn.
Wait a minute. What? First of all, you've seen a 1930s movie with Cary Grant called Gunga Din?
Yeah, did you see it?
No, I don't even know who Gunga Din is.
Oh, it's really wacky. You should watch it. You guys have
I hear Gunga Din, I realize I've all these years I've subconsciously confused Gunga Din and Genghis Khan. They're not the same person, right?
Gunga Din is a poem by Rudyard Kipling about a noble or something.
There's something about carrying water. You're a better man than I, Gunga Din.
You're a better man than I. Yeah. Well, he doesn't carry water in the movie. He gets shot nobly, I think.
Kelly, how many times have you seen Gunga Din?
I've seen Gunga Din, I think, 5 times.
Wow.
Is it a good movie? Like, should we Netflix it?
I don't know if it'd speak to you guys. I saw it when I was 9, and it made an impression on me.
Oh.
So it was the only one of those, like, old-timey adventure movies that did. Like, I thought Robin Hood was a little overrated. And, I don't know. Gunga Din came... I didn't know what Gunga Din was. Like, I got it mixed up with Genghis Khan, too, when I was 9. So I sort of watched it by accident. I got sucked into it.
Thought you were in for, like, a Mongol warrior riding across the steppes, slaughtering people.
Some of that. I don't know. It's kind of racist and imperialistic. But when you're 9, that's okay. Huh, guys?
Okay.
Whitey gets saved by the noble Arab, and then Whitey writes a poem about him.
Well, I will say I've maybe seen 2 Cary Grant movies, and he's so amazingly watchable. Like, so just on that level.
Which 2 have you seen?
There's one. It's not even Alfred Hitchcock. It's one where Walter Matthau is the bad guy, and they're trying to get stamps.
What? Well, I haven't seen that. What are you talking about?
It's some chick like Audrey Hepburn or something, and she shoots him with a squirt gun, or a kid shoots him with a squirt gun, Walter Matthau. I gotta see this.
You know what it's called? Cary Grant, Walter Matthau. It sounds so...
Like Audition or something?
LSD.
Audition?
No, it's not that. What is it? I don't know what it's called. And then the other one is the one where there's like a baby tiger called Baby or what is...
Wait, you didn't see North by Northwest or...
Yes. Yeah, okay. You know what? I have seen North by Northwest, yes. Not recently. Like when I was a kid, I've seen it.
Have you seen the Philadelphia Story?
No. Those old timey Jimmy Stewart things, right? I was in a Little Rock Community Theater production of Philadelphia Story, so there's that.
Oh, fantastic.
What's a great Cary Grant movie? I guess North by Northwest, right?
Well, Gunga Din, because it's really wacky and he's really goofy and dorky in it.
Are you being
serious? Really good. Yeah, no, I am. And there's some really awesome like fight choreography where he like grabs a guy by like a scarf or a turban or something and just swings him into this haymaker. It's like Temple of Doom if Temple of Doom was super cool.
That totally makes me want to see it, Kelly Wand.
It's Temple of Doom-esque. It's the precursor to Temple of Doom. And I'm a Temple of Doom apologist, actually.
I'm with you there. Okay.
I think it's an underrated movie.
Dingus might have that on his list, by the way.
So. Oh, good. I can't wait.
Okay, well, I'm going to Netflix that. I like that, Kelly Wand. This is good.
Gunga Din. Tell me if I oversold Gunga Din, if you see it.
All right.
It's probably free on the internets.
Like tentacles.
It's got other people in it, too, but I only remember Cary Grant.
All right.
It's got Douglas Fairbanks. Wait, hang on. It's my favorite movie. One second.
While Kelly's IMDb-ing Gunga Din, Dingus, what is your number two?
All right, my number two. Fairbanks. Go ahead, Kelly.
He went Douglas Fairbanks. Douglas Fairbanks.
Who's the ingenue?
Joan Fontaine. Also, she was in Notorious. No, what's the one where she thinks Cary Grant?
Oh, I've seen Notorious. I love Notorious. That's Cary Grant.
That's another good Cary Grant, right?
Yeah, he's
right.
A CIA agent. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh,
Suspicion was the one I was just thinking of, though.
Okay, Joan Fontaine is the woman that beat her children with coat hangers, right?
Oh, that's Joan Crawford.
No.
Right. How dare you.
What? Hey, don't know.
Joan Fontaine's never going to live that down.
Sorry, Joan. I'm sorry.
Did you, by any chance, see His Girl Friday?
Isn't that the one with the baby tiger called Baby?
No, that's Bringing Up Baby.
Bringing Up, yeah. No, I've never seen His Girl Friday. Is that Cary Grant?
Yeah.
He's on, and Rosalind Russell?
I don't know.
That's a good film. He's kind of doing a Bogart Cary Grant, that one. Is that the one where he's on the island and he's all kind of...
I love how well equipped we are to talk about old movies.
Yeah, that's great. That's like our physics podcast.
Hang on, Googling Cary Grant.
His Girl Friday is the newspaper one. It's a Howard Hawks film.
Howard Hawks, right. Yeah, I just know that it's Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant, I think. I'm pretty sure. And I have no idea who Rosalind Russell is, but I know she's in it.
I do like Kelly thinking he's on an island.
I'm thinking of something else. I'm totally dumb.
You're thinking of Willem Dafoe.
Oh, I hate you people.
Okay, Dingus, what's your number two movie that you'd bring to a desert island?
All right, this one was fairly easy for me. My number two film that I would bring to a desert island is a 1998 film called Rushmore.
Oh, yay! Okay.
Predictable.
All right, my number two is... No. So predictable.
So predictable.
Dix, you and I have a long-running, I would say, feud, maybe rivalry, maybe battle, where I quite like Rushmore, but I know you would say it's your favorite Wes Anderson movie. Is that correct?
I would go so far as to say it may be my favorite film.
Wow.
And then the podcast went dead.
Well, after Tom said Ice Storm, a lot of things went dead.
Go ahead, Tom, say your piece.
My piece is that I'm suspicious of anyone who can name a single favorite film. That's my piece.
I said it may be. Okay. You can be suspicious of me if you need to be. That's fine.
I don't see how anybody could possibly have like one favorite film. Anybody
your favorite
who, like,
film's
who
Jaws.
Loves appreciates film. No, it's not. I don't have a single favorite film. Mm, I pick a favorite every year, and it changes from year to year. Even and even the one I picked last year might change this year. You know what, Ding? I'm giving you grief, but I totally get where you're coming from, and I love that you love Rushmore. I love, by the way, Dingus, when you and I disagree about stuff, because so often we agree on things, and it's boring as hell.
Mm. Well, the listeners agree with that.
What's funny about this for me is that I generally agree. Actually, I know it's boring as hell, but I generally agree with you with the idea of not having a favorite film. I had this very good friend in college who's a list maker, and he had a list of his 100 favorite films, the 100 best films, and he would update it regularly, and it was from 100 to 1. Ranked in order, and he's just one of these guys who knows how to make lists, and he challenged me to do that, and I said, okay, well, I'll come up with my one, and I got bogged down in how do you possibly rank this film over that film, and how do you come up with that? It just doesn't make any sense to me. My mind just doesn't work that way. But year in, year out,
the Oscars do it every year, and they're about to do it times two.
Well, that's a group of people voting for something, and I understand the politics and the voting. That's different. And I do it every year of a top 10 list, too. I can rank things for a particular year. I'm fine with that. But for whatever reason, this particular film, year in, year out, remains, if not my favorite, one of my favorite films. And every time I sit down to watch it, and I get so excited to watch it, I think I write down, you know, when I'm taking notes about the film, if I'm doing that, is this film, I mean, come on, Christian, is this film really going to be your number one film? It can't be. And then by the end of the film, I'm just convinced that it is. The music, the way it's done, and I understand a lot of people have trouble with Wes Anderson and think he's too precious and all of that. But I just, I can watch this.
Okay. So two things. Hold on. Did you jump ahead to your number one? You have one that you would bring in advance of Rushmore?
Yes, I do.
Okay, that's weird. Okay, and the other thing is, you can't say, for whatever reason, blah, blah, blah. You now have to give us those reasons. What explain to us your fondness for Rushmore in as much as you can. I mean, you can't just, you're an articulate guy. Don't give us a for whatever reason. Go.
What are you talking about? How did I say for whatever reason?
You said, and for whatever reason, by the time the movie is over, I still blah, blah, blah. You know, it was just verbal filler, but I want you to sort of explain why Rushmore appeals to you so much.
I love everything about the film. I love the music, for one thing. I can listen to the music all the time. I love.
You can just get a soundtrack for that.
And I have that, and I listen to it all the time. But I don't think we can bring soundtracks to our island or to the moon.
But you're saying, Dingus, like the music in conjunction with the way the music is used, not just the music, I assume.
Absolutely. And when you have that opening where you have that Mark Mothersbaugh music, and he does the math problem on the board, and he wakes up, and up until that very final moment where he cues the guy to change the record, and they do that slow motion dance, and I find myself just crying at the end. And I love Jason Schwartzman in it. I was so bowled over by him. I remember just thinking, who is this kid? And I just fell for Bill Murray when he has the scene where they're painting out on the lawn with the little kids, and the kid says the line,
that's a jellyfish.
Thank you, Tom. And Bill Murray goes just running away, one of my favorite moments in film that year. And I just love that heartbreaking feeling of falling in love for the first time with somebody there's no possible way you can get, and having to understand what that means and having that longing. I love the sense of longing in the film that goes in so many different directions. Like, not only goes from Max to the teacher, but goes from Bill Murray, that goes to Max's feelings to the school. There's so many different ways that longing works in that film that it just fills me with joy to think about it.
So that's an interesting distinction, I think, between us, Dingus, is that I wouldn't say I have a problem with Rushmore, because I adore the movie, too. I'm a huge Wes Anderson fan, like you. I really do like Rushmore a lot. And every successive time I've seen it, I've appreciated it even more. But Rushmore takes place in this really sort of stylized reality that's partly in Max's head. You know, it's not our reality day to day. And I think the movies that speak to me do so from a more naturalistic, sort of realistic place, without all that stylization and that sort of childhood whimsy that's so much a part of Rushmore. Okay, good pick. And I don't.
No, and I like what you just said there, because I think those movies do speak to me in a more profound way. But if I'm thinking about a movie that I want to watch over and over and over and over again, then that sense of whimsy is something that I can really tap into, because I think there's a good foundation for it in this particular film. It's not just all fantastical, and it's not as flimsy as, say, another movie I really like, Juno, but I think that doesn't have as strong a foundation.
Very good. I agree. Yeah. All right. Good. Well, I'm really eager to see what movie you would take in advance of Rushmore, if you consider that your favorite movie of all time ever. Because that's what
you're going over Jaws, the movie you're gayest for ever.
Yeah, but there's one that I'm even gayer for that I'm taking on Desert Island first. Is it my turn?
I think so.
Oh,
nicely done, Kelly. You just did a real radio serve it up. Good job.
Mr. MC Kelly Wand.
I hate to make people listen one extra second, except this one.
Well done. That was 3 seconds. My number one movie is a deeply flawed film, and a lot of people think that it's incredibly pretentious, and I don't necessarily disagree with them. It's something I can watch over and over again. It has so much to say about it's sort of like, Kelly, you talking about bringing 2001 for your spiritual needs.
When did you see my number one, dude?
Well, this movie I feel the same way about. I mean, on a spiritual level, I really get a lot out of this movie. It has a lot about love and death and attachment. It's Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain.
Ah! Oh, nice!
Good one.
And I've seen The Fountain
good one.
A dozen times, and it
Very impressive.
Just deeply flawed, but none of the flaws bothers me in the least. And
I'm a huge Fountain apologist.
As am I. But you know, the thing is, I totally understand people who don't like it. I mean, it's a
good, I don't care about them.
But it's a very personal movie. Like, you either get what Darren Aronofsky is trying to say, or you don't, and that's fine. But it also includes just Matthew Libatique's cinematography, just in top form. I don't care for Hugh Jackman normally, but he's amazing in it. I always love Rachel Weisz. They're so good together. I love the parallel storylines and how they overlap and don't overlap. I love what it has to say about treasure and politics and disease and nationalism and time. And it's just on so many different levels, for so many different reasons, that movie means so much to me. And I would not want to be without it on a desert island. So there's my number one.
Is the future story thread real in The Fountain?
I think that examine. I have a hard time. Normally, I can be as analytical as the next guy, more so. But I have a hard time being super analytical with The Fountain and answering questions like that with a definitive yes or no. My actual answer is that I don't care. And I'm not being flippant. I mean, that's just sort of really how I sort of receive whatever that movie is giving.
I don't care either, but I like to think about it.
And I don't think any of it is real. In a way, I think the book is sort of, the movie is sort of this book that was written on a deathbed, maybe. There's that sort of idea. And it's coming to terms with loss. And
I thought it was all real, even the Columbus stuff.
But each of the storylines informs the other in very important ways, like what the character does with gold, for instance, in the storyline. Like, he's searching for gold in the past, and Hugh Jackman loses his ring in the present, and it's sort of a symbol of his love, just like finding gold for Queen Isabella is a symbol of this sort of love and nationalism in the past. And in the future, he lets it go, and he just tattoos it onto his skin, the ring, and the sort of representation of treasure expressing love. So that there's all these different layers like that just occur to me. And even if they make no sense to anyone else, that's fine. And they may not even bear up. But it's just like this poem I can read over and over again and get different things from each time. But it happens to be a movie.
Now I understand.
That's a beautiful way to put it, by the way, that poem thing. And you really took me by surprise, because as I was thinking about this week, I was thinking about how much you like Requiem for a Dream. And thinking, well, there's no way he's going to pick that. I mean, who, as much as I love that film, I just couldn't live for the rest of time with Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
And I didn't, even though I had a discussion with a guy this week about The Fountain and how much I love it and the things I love about it and what struck me about it, I didn't think about it for this list. And you really took me by surprise. That's great.
Yeah. All right. Over top that, Kelly Wand.
Yeah. My number one, follow-up to your The Fountain selection, is the movie Zapped.
What the hell?
Because...
God, Bayo!
What?
Good, see? Directed by Robert J. Rosenthal, 1982, Heather Thomas, Scott Baio, Willie Ames. Several reasons. A... It's about telekinesis, which I think is a way off the island. And B, I need something light to sort of counterbalance the 2001.
And Gunga Din.
Yeah, oh, and Gunga Din, which is also light.
I thought you were going to say it because there's a topless chick in it. But, okay.
Well, it's not really Heather Thomas, but it should have been. But, you know, The Fountain, Zapped, same thing.
That is awesome.
Not only have I never seen Zapped, I've never even heard of this.
I'm going to mail you a DVD this week.
You know, I'm going to watch Gunga Din, but I'm not watching Zapped. Is it spelled Z-A-P-T?
No, but the Jason Bateman sequel, I think, has a special two that looks like a Z.
Are you lying? There's a sequel with Jason Bateman?
Yeah.
I will see that. I'm not seeing anything with Scott Aim, Willie
Ames. No, it's good. There's a great scene with Scatman Crothers and some salamis. Which I don't want to see that.
Wow.
So, you know, by the way, that Walter Matthau Cary Grant movie was called Charade.
Charade! It's kind of like an audition, like you're auditioning for charades.
And one where he's on the island was Father Goose, so.
All right.
Is that how you did audition?
Is that how what?
Is that how you did auditions, Tom?
And it always easier than memorizing.
Before they came out with talkies.
Wow, well, is there anything more to say about Zapped? Because, you know, that was an awesome choice.
Well, I don't want to spoil it. Okay. You know.
All right.
Aren't you embarrassed to pick the fountain now when I had Zapped?
You did. You stole my thunder, Kelly Wand. Wow.
2001 Gunga Din Zapped.
Ice Storm Jaws.
I can stay on this island forever now.
Okay.
I don't even All want right. off the island now that I got these movies.
All right, Dingus, so you did Empire Strikes Back, Rushmore, and what could possibly top those two? Rock and roll, go.
Teen Wolf. No, it wasn't.
Overrated.
All right, my number one film that I want to take with me is a film from 1988 called Midnight Run.
Oh, I could have guessed that. Oh, good Lord.
Surprised
predictable.
You
You're so predictable. Well, I happen to know. I mean, go ahead, Dingus.
I don't know what to say. Every time I watch this film, it makes me
For whatever reason.
And it makes me cry, too. It's one of those films I can't skip. If I happen to be flipping channels and it's on TV, I'll stop even to watch the crappy TV edits of the language, which I really don't like. I just love it. I think it's the perfect buddy film. Robert De Niro.
Zap's a good buddy.
He's showing he can be funny without seeming to try to be, and it's got Charles Grodin before 9/11 made him crazy and lose his sense of humor, and it always makes me laugh. And it also has another one of my favorite scores. It's this really quirky Danny Elfman score that you wouldn't even think is Danny Elfman. It's got this weird sort of bluesy vibe to it I'm crazy about it.
Wow. Can you give us a few choice lines?
I could, but that would get pedantic.
Do a Dennis Farina line from it involving a pencil.
I'd prefer a Yaphet Kotto line.
I'm Mowgli.
Good. Now can you hum a little of the Danny Elfman soundtrack?
I won't do that.
Okay. Now you say it makes you cry. Does it get super heartfelt? Like, I don't really remember enough
either.
About what happened. Like, does it really get, like, I'm not giving you a hard time, but it really gets touching at the end?
Well, there's two moments that actually touch me, and I'm a total sucker for this movie. There's a moment where they're stuck near where he used to live in Chicago. He's constantly talking about Chicago. And he goes to his ex-wife's house. And his daughter, who he hasn't seen in years and years and years, comes out to give him her babysitting money because he needs money. And he refuses it. And it's this beautiful, touching – they don't know each other, but they're father and daughter, and he is completely humiliated by his love for her, essentially, and that really just knocks me out every time.
Nice. And what's the other moment then?
The end. I fall for the end when they have their little moment. But the part that really makes me cry is the moment I just said.
And now, who directed Midnight Run?
Martin Brest, who went on to do Meet Joe Black and Gigli. Which was Tom's original.
Oh, ouch. Now, is it directed well, Dingus, or is it mostly a matter of the leads and maybe the script? Like,
I think it's very well directed, and it's one of these examples of a guy who did one film and then just see ya, wouldn't want to be ya. Right. I think it's very well directed and very well put together and very funny, and it's also a pretty good action film. I think it's a great buddy film.
Okay, good. Good. All right. Well, that's I could have predicted your list, Dingus.
Yeah, I'm sure you could have. Again, these are films that I can see over and over and over and over again. And so I had a list of, you know, 5 or 10 films that I had to choose from. And I had to really sort of sit there and think, what are the films that I can watch again and again and again every year?
That was written by the same dude who wrote Bad Boys 2 and C-Spot Run.
George Gallo.
Wow.
Now,
Dingus, I have a question. Why does this come ahead of Rushmore?
Just based on the number, I think the number of times I've seen it, not just because it's older, but I could really watch it. I have the feeling that I could watch it every month. And Rushmore, I like to leave. I like to sort of delay my gratification on, but I could watch Midnight Run all the time.
Good.
I've only seen it once, and now I kind of want to see it again.
Basically. Well, there's no way it can live up to how
it's never on.
All right, those were good lists. I mean, despite my reservations expressed early on, that was a great topic, Dingus. Very well done.
Well, I think Kelly will agree with me. I think you clearly win the 3x3 this week with the Fountain.
Yeah.
Well, there's no winning. We just had very different approaches.
Jaws, too.
Yeah, I'm surprised you guys didn't try to scoop me on Jaws.
You've got a lot of you've got water and water-like substances in your list, Tom.
Water and water-like substances.
And a desert island's kind of like that tree floating up into space.
Yeah. Ah, well, you know, water always represents like what? Like birth. So it's one of those, like, it's always shorthand for a theme, you know.
So. Well, you've got ice storm, Jaws, Fountain.
Yeah, what's ice represent?
Frozen water.
What do avatars represent?
You think water's fast? Try ice.
Ah, that leads into next week's 3x3, Dingus. Very well done. So Dingus is referencing the scene in Deep Blue Sea where Samuel Jackson, the movie subverts the audience expectations. Samuel Jackson is going to deliver this rousing speech, and he's going to rally the survivors to survive against the sharks. And in the middle of the speech, the shark jumps out and eats him. Everybody knows that scene. It's a classic example of Rennie Harlan playing on audience expectation and then subverting it. He breaks the rules to great effect.
Does he only do it in that one movie, though?
Twister was full of those things. I'm kidding. there were a couple of those in Deep Blue Sea. I mean, when Saffron Burrows gets eaten at the end. Yeah. I'm a Deep Blue Sea apologist. I think we all are.
No, I am too.
Okay.
That's the movie that made me like Rennie Harlan, actually. I thought he was a total dick move.
What I want from you guys next week is I want three examples of scenes that subvert expectations, like Samuel Jackson's death in Deep Blue Sea, or like Harrison Ford shooting the guy who whips out the sword in Indiana Jones and in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Not a movie. Like, for instance, earlier this year, Moon did a great job of subverting this idea about a rogue AI, which is a trope in science fiction movies. I don't want anything broad like that. I want a specific instance in a movie where the audience expectation is subverted, where the director breaks the rules of sort of established movie vocabulary. So next week, that'll be our 3x3.
Can I use Deep Blue Sea?
You can't use Deep Blue Sea or Indiana or Raiders of the Lost Ark, I'm afraid.
Oh, thanks.
So what movie should we see next week?
Didn't we already decide this?
Yeah.
On our own time instead of the listener's time.
So I think in honor of my number two, we should see The Fabulous Mr. Fox, The Fantastic Mr. Fox. I don't even know what it's called.
We're not going to find The Fabulous Mr. Fox. So, join us next week. We will see The Fantastic Mr. Fox. You've got a week to have seen it because we will be discussing it with spoilers. And come on back and hear what our 3x3 is of scenes that break the rules. So thank you for joining us, and we will see everyone here next week.